Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandergriff.
It's Tuesday, May 21st. From HPR2, it's The Conversation. We don't need a psychic, but how about a better channel for stormwater drainage?
Beauty is in the ear of the hearer.
The birthplace of Baha'i would see its demise.
Creativity, how about spontaneous discipline?
Plus the worldview from Deutsche Welle, a backyard big name, and edgy dredgers flossing the jetsam.
People are strange when you're a stranger. Faces look ugly when you're alone. Women seem wicked when you're unwanted. Streets are uneven when you're down, when you're strange. Faces come out of the rain when you're strange. No one remembers your name when you're strange. When you're strange, when you're strange.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. When there's water running everywhere, how do you control it and all the pollution it carries along? The EPA's Clean Water Act has been wrestling with that question for decades. Starting June 1st, new or redeveloped commercial projects in the city and county of Honolulu will have to meet changed standards for stormwater drainage. The revised rules were mandated when the city was reissued its National Pollution Discharge Elimination System permit 2 years ago. This morning, we talked with Art Chalakom, the Deputy Director of the Department of Planning and Permitting, about what stormwater containment looks like now.
The idea is to allow the natural recharge system on a site to work and to basically, where as much as practicable, is to keep that retention on site.
Why, there's a lot of green borders that we see around parking lots.
Exactly. And basically, Beth Ann, you hit the nail right on the head. It's basically a green solution to eliminating pollutants from our stormwater runoff. Essentially, the whole goal is to protect our streams and oceans from non-point source pollutants.
But for example, Art, when we take a look at a huge storm that dumps a lot of water really quickly, like think about this past weekend, both Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
Big downpours, a lot of volume of water coming down. Can even that green space that borders a lot of the parking lots and structures that we're talking about actually cope with all of that? Or does it, in fact, just sort of, you know, slide away?
Well, it can't take in large storm events. No site can absorb all of the runoff. That's why we have the stormwater management rules amendments that we do right now, is to, where that runoff does go off site, is to have what we call best management practices. That is, strategies that would essentially remove as many of the pollutants as possible before discharging into our storm drain system and eventually out into our streams and into the oceans.
And yet we have a lot of detritus turning up anyway. Is there something else that needs to be between where it's running off and obviously the stream?
And that's where the best management practices come into play, and that's why with new development and redevelopment, that's why our department is charged with reviewing all of the permit applications related to that. And let me just go into the criteria for what projects qualify under the new stormwater quality rules. Essentially, we have two categories. It's Priority A projects and Priority B projects. Priority A projects are projects that will disturb ground 1 acre or more. So, for example, a subdivision, the large residential subdivision, would fall under that criteria. And prior to approval of that subdivision, our staff would be reviewing the application to make sure that best management practices are in place that will basically achieve what we call low impact development. It's essentially a site design strategy to, again, reduce as much as practical the pollutants contained in stormwater runoff going off site.
We're talking about big stuff like things that it's actually able to catch.
Right. For example, a retention basin would be probably the primary best management technique for a large project. Basically, a grass retention basin to keep as much stormwater on site as possible. The next category, and this is the category that my staff is really going to take note of and really take a lot of reviews, are the priority B projects, and they're very specific. These are projects that have a total impervious surface area equal or greater than 10,000 square feet and include retail gas stations, auto repair shops, restaurants, and parking lots.
And we know with those structures, there's a lot of other junk that is going to be discharged, things that will be on the pavement, not necessarily the big stuff that would be able to be caught by some sort of catchment.
And those are, again, the best management practices that we're looking at in these Priority B projects. And each Priority B project has its own specific checklist under our rules that when an applicant comes in for a building permit, what they will have to do is they will have to fill out a stormwater quality checklist for new development and redevelopment. And essentially, each checklist is unique to that specific type of Priority B project, the four that I mentioned previously. For example, the retail gas outlet Priority B, if they come in for a building permit application, all storm drain inlets and catch basins will include appropriate stenciling, so it's identified as a storm drain inlet or catch basin, so that people don't mistakenly dump pollutants into that drain inlet. Fuel dispensing areas, what we want to see is a cover with a roof or canopy paved with Portland cement concrete. We want to see underground tanks and spill contaminant and overfill prevention systems included in our plans. We want the use of fuel dispensing nozzles with automatic shutoffs. Just to give you an example of some of the things we're looking at.
Okay, but don't we have a lot of those now anyway? I mean, that seems to be what you're describing, sort of the average corner gas station.
No, not really. Essentially, these are not part of the building permit review process currently. They now would be.
Okay, and how many of these projects do you think are on the books now or that we can see in the coming year?
Well, let me just say, I don't have a specific number for you. We do start implementing our stormwater management rules June 1st, but I do want to let your listeners know that this does not include single-family homes like in Manoa or Mililani. These are only commercial projects or large projects, an acre or more of disturbing ground. But I don't have a number for you.
Okay, so we don't really know kind of how much this is going to be impacting our communities or having a sense of how much it will take care of. It's just sort of for whatever it is that may be either redeveloped or newly developed from this point forward.
That's correct.
All right, well, we'll have to see who takes you up on that. I've got a corner gas station not far from where I live, and it looks like they've been doing a great deal of redevelopment, which is to say that they got into this before this permitting process had to be put into place?
That's correct. We're essentially, for our checklists on June 1st, if folks come in with applications that don't have them, we're not going to actually turn them away at first. We're going to basically try and educate them. We have flyers and handouts that we're going to give to our applicants, but we will require that they fill the checklist, and the checklist has to be signed by the owner and the architect or engineer supervising the work will have to have their stamp and signature on the checklist, so that we know that they are aware and that they have included these best management practices on their plans.
All right. Well, we're going to leave it there for the moment. Thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Okay. Thanks, Beth Ann.
Art Chalicombe is the Deputy Director of the Department of Planning and Permitting for the City and County of Honolulu. It's his job to make sure developers adhere to the city's land use ordinance, construction, development, engineering, and architectural fields. You can read the revised runoff rules for yourself on our new website, hpr2.org. This is the conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, a theater of sound and beauty signifying everything. And does dredging up the past mean still paddling with poop? First, naming names in the backyard.
Umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, ohawai.
It's common in Hawaii to see names of old families honored on street signs, commercial buildings, and educational centers. Often, too, the same names may turn up several times on the same or other islands. Today in the backyard, we're walking through the UH Manoa campus toward one of the oldest buildings on the old quad, Gartley Hall. Built in 1921, it was closed in 2009 because of concerns over its structural integrity. Renovation started in May of 2012, and if all goes well, the hall will reopen this August. One day soon, it'll be the home of the Myron B. Thompson School of Social Work. The $12.5 million project will keep the historic facade and its name. Just about everything else goes. For your quiz today, can you tell us why Gartley Hall and Gartley Place off the old Polly Road bear the name Gartley? Extra credit if you know how the most widely grown hibiscus in Southern California, the Agnes Galt hybrid, fits into this story. We'll reconstruct the answer in about 20 minutes.
Aloha, I'm Eddie Ortiz from Son Caribe. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Continue the conversation with us by following us on Twitter. Our handle is at HI Conversation.
Few playwrights have done as much to bring the Asian experience to the contemporary American stage as David Henry Hwang, with such works as FOB and M. Butterfly. In the pair of one-act plays called Sound and Beauty, he takes us inside Japan in reality and in legend and looks at the energies that draw people together. Tori Kinoshita is the director of the upcoming Kumu Kahua production, and she's with us in CR7 this morning. Good morning.
Good morning. Hey, Chris, how are you?
Good to have you on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I get the impression that these plays have a kind of a mystical aura. Is that right?
The first one, The Sound of a Voice, certainly does. It's set in the 1700s in Japan, and it's vaguely expressionistic.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of overt symbolism and we're using some movements as was done in the original production. So,
what kind of movements? You mean sort of dance related gesture?
Buteau inspired, because actual
really?
Buteau would be 20 years, and our uh-huh. dancer doesn't have 20 years of Buteau practice, but.
But movement is a means of advancing the story, advancing the movement.
Oh yes, definitely, yeah, and it functions expressionistically in that we're seeing sort of the subjective viewpoint of the man as he comes apart and unravels, and his objective is threatened by falling in love with this woman, etc.
How many characters in this one?
So there's the two characters, and then we have a mover, and then the same with the other play, House of Sleeping Beauties. A man and a woman, and a mover.
What are the common threads, if any, between these two?
Oh gosh, plays? There's so many. There's
really?
So oh yeah, not just in the dialogue, but also in the premise. In both plays, there's a man that's coming to essentially destroy a woman, and he ends up being changed or falling in love with her, and then sort of in the first play, they both. Lose, and in the second play they both win because it's it's love, right? Love is cannot be conditional. There's no win or lose paradigms. It's you both win or you both lose.
So. Hard to predict too. Hard to predict the outcomes, right?
No, indeed. It's fascinating too because in some of the research I did, a lot of critics point to these two plays, which are indeed his first theatrical forays out of the Chinese American perspective, as precursors to the role of Song Li Ling in M. Butterfly, the two female characters being precursors to the role of Song Li Ling. And thinking of it in those terms, it actually makes quite a bit of sense, because in both plays, it is actually the woman that is in control, and it is her, power sort of that is threatening the male gender role identity. And
well, for people who aren't familiar with M. Butterfly, how explain that a little bit, if you will, how they're precursors. What are the character traits that make them precursors?
M. Butterfly is another brilliant play by Henry David Hwang, and it's about a French spy that falls in love with what he thinks is a beautiful Chinese opera performer, and then he finds out, of course, that she's sort of spying on him, and that she's in fact a man, and then it's sort of also about how the West is always feminizing the East, and so it was natural to put us this man in this female character role, so to speak. And then so the fact that in M. Butterfly, the central character Gallimard believes that it's him that's in control, and he's protecting this little fragile delicate Song Li Ling,
China doll.
Right, exactly,
the China doll cliche, right?
Exactly. Oh, it's so brilliant. And then, but ultimately, it's Song Li Ling who is.
She's pulling the strings.
Yeah, pulling the strings, right? So the idea that these two characters, these two women, are precursors to Song Li Ling, to me rings very true, because, of course, it's not till sort of the plays progress where the men begin to become aware of the fact that they are in fact
that strings are being pulled.
Strings are being pulled.
It sounds eerily similar to real life.
Dude.
There got to be some parallels there, right?
Little,
would you think,
yes.
Tori?
Yeah, the universal.
Well, I guess
human
that's what theater is for, right?
Right.
You were telling me that the both men in these two one actors come to the women with what you described as kind of a destructive intent. Is that right?
Yeah, they do. They do.
In what way? I mean, how are they seeking to destroy, do harm?
In The Sound of a Voice, the samurai is seeking out to gain glory by killing what he's heard is a witch in the woods.
Ah.
And then in House of Sleeping Beauties, it's actually Kawabata the character Kawabata is coming to write about this actually secret brothel where the men sleep next to unconscious women. They just sleep next to them. They don't do anything to the women. They're just sleeping next to them. But still, the fact that they're sleeping next to unconscious naked women, it's a big secret, and he's going to write about it and destroy the house, possibly. And that one is actually based on, The House of Sleeping Beauties is based on Yasunari Kawabata, the Nobel Prize winning writer's story, The House of Sleeping Beauty. But so in it, Hwang puts the character as writing the work of art. And then so his life and art kind of become united.
Mm-hmm.
So it's also sort of a comment on the artistic process itself, that play. And that's the main difference.
So he comes to the House of Sleeping Beauties to sort of expose it and dismantle it in a way.
Yes.
That's his destructive intent.
That is his destructive intent. Although it's sort of a double objective because he also is very interested in what actually happens.
So there's an erotic pull to all this.
Right.
And as with most erotic pulls, he ends up... being taken in directions he perhaps did not anticipate. Is that right?
Yes, yes, indeed.
Or just a lucky guess.
Yeah, indeed. That's pretty much it. Yes.
Well, the challenge of having two one-actors, and I assume you have an intermission in between,
yes,
yeah?
Yes, yeah.
Is obviously because they're two separate works, they go in two separate places. And even though there are common threads between them, how do you sort of sustain, how do you make each one have a kind of an equal effectiveness, equal impact?
Well, the text itself, you know, I think takes care of it for us in the sense that they're both very poignant in their own way. And then obviously we've underscored a lot of the parallels visually and spatially, and then, you know, trying to sort of highlight different similarities. For example, Kawabata in House of Sleeping Beauties has a memory where he's talking about smelling a woman's hair. So then, you know, we added that into Sound of a Voice. So there's kind of direct parallels to the summarize.
Those are the ways that you as a director can kind of bring coherence to the thing.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah, trying. Yes,
well, are you enjoying working on this show?
Oh, yes. Yeah, absolutely. The cast is fantastic. They're so nice and everybody works so hard. They're so professional and wonderful. It's nice. I love war metaphors for theater. Some people prefer sports metaphors, but I prefer war metaphors.
So you're ready to do battle.
Yes, everybody has to be working their hardest, you know, or else you fail, you lose the battle.
Well, I assume the audience is not the enemy, right?
No.
They're your allies.
No.
Tori, great to have you on the show.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you.
Tori Kinoshita is the director of the Hawaii premiere at Kumu Kahua Theater of Sound and Beauty, 2 one-act plays by David Henry Huang. And details are on our website, hpr2.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from First Insurance Company of Hawaii, providing auto insurance since 1911, committed to delivering personal attention and expert advice. First Insurance Company of Hawaii, FICOH.com.
Talk of the Nation provides you with the day's news and more, the experiences and opinions of people around the country and around the world. I'm Jennifer Ludden. When you're looking for the latest news and how it affects you, your family, your neighbors, your life, turn to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Weekday mornings from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR listeners who are also members recognize the vital connection between their support and the station's health. Mahalo to Mary Dizon of Honolulu, Peter Wolf of Kailua, and Gerald and Nina Garcia of Kailua Kona for their membership gifts. Many members prefer the convenience of giving monthly through the station's lifetime membership program. Choose the amount you want to give, adjust it at any time in the future, and you'll be secure in knowing you've done your part. Information and a downloadable gift form are at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported HPR2. Honolulu's Alawai Canal is the most heavily used recreational inland waterway in the state. But it's polluted. Canoe paddlers regularly complain of infections, and it's tough to miss the tires, plastic food wrappers, and other floating stuff. for the U Factor on today's Reality Check. Chad Blair joined us once again, and it is you. Chad, you there?
I am. Can you hear me, Beth Ann?
Now I can hear you.
Oh, that's good.
I thought you were reacting to the fact that this was really very dirty business that we're talking about, because it's not as if we're just pointing a finger or anecdotally saying, look, there's a problem with the Alawite. We know this stuff. Even looking at the city's own data from 2006 through April of this year, you know, there's enterococci in there. That's, you know, the stuff that you find in human and animal guts translated to poop.
So we have this series running all week. Sophie Koch, the reporter, and with the aid of Patty Epler, I plugged them because they did a terrific job. And as I was driving home last night, I went along the Alawai. You know, I looked over, and there's paddlers, like a flotilla of canoes in there. And I'm going, I just want to stop the car and get out and say, guys, you know, what are you doing? But the point is that it's a very nice, flat body of water, and they say it's even worth it, even with the infections that they get, I guess, as long as they go home and take a shower. But in fact, it's very seriously polluted. That is one of the things that our series has revealed, the actual levels of bacteria and heavy metals that are in that water.
Now, unfortunately, it's not being regularly monitored, and that's because there have been so many budget cuts that the monitoring staff was cut from 5 to 1. Yet you would think, though, because this is the most highly used waterway, that this would be the first place that we would be going to test.
Yeah. And that's the Department of Health's Clean Water Branch. There just isn't the staffing for that. We did some testing of our own. You know, besides the paddlers, there's a lot of people that fish in that water, and they fish for fish and crabs. One of the people that we talked to actually sells his catch in Chinatown. I know it's
disturbing.
I know. We Civil Beat actually had samples of fish and crab independently tested, and what they showed was excessive levels of the kind of bacteria that causes food poisoning, and along with levels of arsenic, lead, and mercury. And it's hard to imagine that people would actually consume that food, no matter how much butter you put on it.
Not going to make that part any better. But, I mean, this is really difficult stuff to talk about, because in some cases this may be getting into food sources without a lot of disclosure, clearly by the example that you just talked about. Forgetting all the warning signs, they don't seem to be working. What has to happen now?
Well, I think I think we do care, and this is something we can talk about as we continue with the series later this week. I think what I'll end with here today is to let you know that it has a lot to do with funding. The Army Corps of Engineers has not dredged that canal since 2002. It should be dredged every 10 years, but that's a $10 million cost. So that's one thing we could do, is dredge the canal.
But we're going to pay for it in one way or the other. I'm thinking about that woman who got a similar infection to the fellow who actually fell into the Alawai Canal after 2006 and the spill of effluents. We had to pay out $200,000 for that.
That's right.
This is still big money.
That's right. She got an infection. And by the way, she was surfing off of Waikiki right around the time that 48 million gallons of raw sewage was dumped because of that pipe breaking in Waikiki. So it's a very serious health threat in any number of ways.
And we're going to talk more about it as the week progresses. Thanks, Chad.
Sure, Beth Ann. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
You bet. And I'll still be saying, ew.
Ew.
Imagine you're arrested at your home, held for 20 months without charge, allowed scant contact with legal counsel, and then sentenced to 20 years in prison in Iran, just for being Baha'i. 5 years ago, 7 followers of the faith found themselves in that scenario. This week, Hawaii Baha'i members are marking the milestone and focusing attention on all the Baha'i falsely imprisoned, about 100 of them, and 550 more awaiting trial. Molly Sperry is the Secretary General of the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the Hawaiian Islands. She joins us this morning. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
There is an irony to all this that, you know, the Baha'i faith started in Iran, and now it's seemingly being eradicated, 1 to 500 people at a time, perhaps, but there are 300,000 behind them. What do you make of all of this, considering that Iran did sign a treaty It did sign the International Covenants on Human Rights, and yet in many ways we're seeing it just fly in the face of that.
Mm. Well, to begin with, it's not unusual that a religion that begins in a country is persecuted by that country. So 170 years ago, the Baha'i faith issued into this world and was and has been persecuted in Iran and has been persecuted ever since. But more recently, since the Islamic revolution in 1979, there has been systematic persecution, daily and harsh, and it has been escalating through the last 30 years, in the last 2 years particularly, where you've mentioned some Iranian, Baha'is being imprisoned, and many in the wings to be imprisoned. Such injustices of human rights are not unprecedented, but in this world where we are looking to assure human rights across the world in order to really ensure peace, this makes this issue very important. And that's why, so it's not unusual, but it's very important in this day and age when we know
how that it could be somebody else tomorrow.
It is. And actually, Iran, I love the news piece that we just listened to because it spoke of the anti-Semitism that is also prevalent in Iran and rising. That's what the newscast said. So I think that it's really part of this issue. And our community of Baha'is and friends of the Baha'is and people that want to uphold justice and protect human rights want to speak out at this time in a grave way so that we don't watch a population, a minority in a community be eradicated.
Now, you've been speaking out for a while and trying to go through the UN. UN Secretary General has vehemently said that these violations of human rights, that they're not condoning these at all in way, shape, or form in Iran going on. But it just seems to be a lot of words that's been happening over time. Now you're trying to work through the U.S. Congress. There are a couple of resolutions, one in the Senate, one in the House. They're identical, but you're trying to get some movement and some focus on this, especially during this week. Is this going to be enough just to have a resolution? Are they really paying attention to more words?
Well, we have some evidence that the situation in Iran is affected by world opinion and world action and the pressure placed on Iran, but we want to increase that pressure. And so we're asking this sharing today is asking the listeners to join us and ask our senators and our House of Representatives to co-sponsor these bills that are there, the resolution. So the stronger those bills are, the more pressure, influence it might have on our President and our Secretary of State to impose increased sanctions. That's what it asked for. So
But Molly, I mean, I guess the question for a lot of people, having looked at how Iran has behaved in just the last few years, really wondering if this is going to have any impact and what will have to happen for there to be action. I mean,
that's a good question.
Well, I mean,
we can do what we can do.
Point. Right. And you're going to do what you can do.
Right.
But is there going to be something that you would think as this is going to be the turning point, something that would have to happen? We've been trying to work through other nations which have had political prisoners or prisoners based on different religious persuasions for years. I mean, this is not a new kind of things that happened only strictly, as you've mentioned, with Baha'i. But it seems that we have a lot of words, and you're talking about people who've been in prison. You're talking about mothers and fathers and kids in some cases. The article in Civil Beat talks about a couple of mothers who are there with their infants. And we as Americans probably wouldn't think that this is anything that would be possible, and yet we know it's happening, according to at least these reports. So how do you act when you're on the other side of that?
Such a good question. And I go back to we do what we can do. And one of the things we can do is raise awareness all over the world, which is what's happening this particular month. It's this week for Hawaii, but around the world, if you look at Baha'i Hawaii website, and then you can get to a world website that speaks of the different countries that are stepping forward condemning Iran for its abuse of human rights. I'm not sure. We do what we can, and we want to raise the public awareness to such a degree that it impacts Iran to the greatest degree. And I know you're saying, what action can we take?
And the reason why is, in the time of the Second World War, where people were saying, but this is going on in Germany, and there are people who simply just turned a blind eye to it, and or some, in fact, profited from it. It doesn't matter which group you're talking about. If you have some people who are trying to raise awareness like you and others who are simply turning blind eyes, which we know will happen because some people simply won't care, and yet this universality aspect of the Baha'i faith and looking at what binds us as humans, which is the part that we think that as Americans we plug into a whole lot, and how we are feeling so empowered by our view toward human rights to spread that message through the world in places where human rights doesn't have any value.
I think that just raising the awareness is the best thing we can do, that we make every single person aware of what's going on and asking them to raise their voices and apply pressure, because we're not really a violent, this isn't a violent effort, and we wouldn't, you referenced World War II, and we have to do this through peaceful means and get hearts to change.
Well, I thought they were doing that before World War II, too. And I'm not suggesting that this is going to lead into some sort of a war. But looking at where does that line get crossed, and what do we do beyond that? That seems to be the question that we ask about Iran in so many ways, not just about what's happening with the Baha'i, but where are those lines that get crossed that we say, no, this point and no further? And what can we do with the country? Where does the world get to step into a country and say, no, you can't do that? That seems to be always the essential question that we ask.
Right, and as you mentioned before, Iran has agreed to human rights protection in the covenants of human rights, and we're calling them to their promise to abide by that. And I think monitoring it and looking at it and calling the attention of the abuse is what we can do. And we also can begin to build, I think, a better world where we are. Make sure that we ourselves are abiding by human rights and taking care of our community, so that it becomes better and stronger, and it will then.
Molly, we got to leave it there.
I'm so sorry.
Don't be sorry. Yeah. The essential point is, it all starts with you. It all starts with me, and what each of us can do, starting with how we behave ourselves. That's what I just heard you say.
Thank you.
Thanks, Molly. Molly Sperry is a former four-decade educator on Oahu and the Big Island. She's now the Secretary General of the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'is of the Hawaiian Islands. This week, members are marking the 5 years that seven Baha'i leaders have been imprisoned in Iran. A link to an article about it is on civilbeat.com. You can get to it through our website, hawaiihpr2.org.
Support for today's programming comes from Alaska Airlines, recently named highest in customer satisfaction among traditional North American network carriers by J.D. Power and Associates for the sixth year in a row. AlaskaAir.com.
Today we visited the UH Manoa campus to check on the progress of Gartley Hall. In late 2009, the school closed it amid concerns for safety after structural damage, and renovation only began a year ago. Built in 1921, the building was a chemistry and sugar technology lab. When it reopens, it will house the Myron B. Thompson School of Social Work. The $12.5 million project was designed to meet LEED Silver certification, but after all the modernization, Gartley Hall will still be Gartley Hall. And we asked you where the building and Gartley Place off the old Polly Road got their names. Both honor a U.S. Naval officer who settled here in 1900. He was Hawaiian Electric Company's first manager, and from 1910 until his death in 1921, he was vice president at C. Brewer & Company, where his sugarcane milling machinery made him famous. Chairman of the first UH Board of Regents, founder of the Hawaiian Engineering Association, now Engineers and Architects of Hawaii, and a photographer whose work is cataloged by the Bishop Museum, Alonzo Gartley holds a place in Hawaii's history and its future for students who will once again study in Gartley Hall. As for the Agnes Galt hibiscus hybrid we gave you as a hint, well, he created that one too. That's your quiz for today, and thanks to Peter Rossig for sending it in. If you've got one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
You can't keep kids from making art. It just bursts out of them. Sometimes it seems as if we all start out as artists, and some of us just lose our way. It's great to have that creative impulse, but real art is as much about discipline as it is about spontaneity. How, then, can you give young people the awareness that creativity needs to be channeled, honed, and developed over the course of a lifetime? That's a long way from just doing what comes naturally. Lori Rubin, Associate Director of the Ohana Arts Performing Arts Festival and School, has some thoughts on that subject, and she's with us this morning. Good morning, Lori.
Good morning.
I know that working with kids in the arts, you probably don't have any trouble motivating them to bring some energy to the task, do you?
They have a lot of energy. Some of the kids surprise us. Those who have never been on stage before just come out with these incredible talents, and their parents are shocked. We're shocked. They are shocked. It's unbelievable to see, and it's wonderful to bring out of them.
You know, a lot of theater people and performing artists are they do surprise people when they get on stage, because mm-hmm. that's kind of where they come alive. Do you see that with some of the kids in your program?
Yeah. We had a student a couple years ago who was so shy, and we had been warned about that, and she even said that, and we saw her in many social situations where she was extremely shy, and then we gave her a role that we actually wanted to see how she would be when she would act. And it was like everything opened up and she became a totally different person. And it was just unreal. And it kind of reminded me of what I heard about Jim Henson. I heard he was an incredibly shy person. And when he did the voices of Kermit and Ernie, it was just he was who he was inside. Everybody saw who that was. It was incredible.
Well, there's certainly a lot of in the biographies that you read of people in the performing arts, there are a lot of stories about painful shyness and mm-hmm. also sort of finding a little bit of comfort in being finding liberation in being somebody else. That sounds like what you're describing with your young friend.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think what happens is that we can always relate to a character, no matter how obscure their story might seem. But you find yourself in people, and I think it is easier to come out through somebody else rather than to have to do that yourself without sort of having to expose and to feel very vulnerable in person. But it's easier to be yourself when you can sort of be in the guise of somebody else.
Is that part of the value, that you're less vulnerable in a persona?
Possibly, yeah.
I think it might be.
Yeah, definitely.
It does seem that way. Well, do you, you know, how do you sort of make kids appreciate the value of learning skills? You know, taking your talent, taking your impulse to perform, and adding layers of skill onto that.
I think it's at first, the first thing is giving them permission. We've had several situations where students would come in and they'd be super, you know, sort of negative about themselves, you know, really sort of giving a disclaimer, oh, I can't sing, I can't dance. And then all of a sudden it's like you just see what they do and you're like, you know, you're good. Mm-hmm. And it's those are the magic words. If you say the words, you're good, all of a sudden, and they get this permission and then they start to develop this confidence. And we've seen it a number of times. And it's really remarkable. And one of the things that, you know, I try to do is to keep an active performing career. Both Jenny, who's the executive director of Ohana Arts, and I both, you know, try to perform and keep being inspired so that we can come and teach the kids that they can do this too. I think one of the most important things for them is when they come to this program, they see kids on the Disney Channel and they see kids in productions and maybe the national tours that come. You know, when Wicked came, I know people were really excited that Fiero, one of the characters, the main characters, was somebody from Hawaii, and that really deeply inspires them. And so when they see people like us in the flesh and we're teaching them, it makes them feel like they could do it too. It's not something that's totally distant from them.
You know, adults do a lot of, certainly adults are frequently guilty of a kind of self-editing, you know, talking themselves out, oh, I won't be able to do that, before they've even tried.
That's right.
That's a tough one, isn't it?
It is, and I see that in kids too. And I think it's interesting. It comes a lot of times. Parents are sort of editing or sort of coming up with the disclaimers.
He won't be able to do that.
He won't be able to do that, and or you know, I don't want him to do this because he's just gonna get his hopes up and blah blah blah.
Wow, that's a little scary.
Yeah, and of course, what they're trying to do is they're always trying to keep their kids humble, and one always appreciates that. And our favorite experiences is when we see that kids are so humble and, you know, grateful and having a lot of gratitude. But definitely it's really interesting to see things come, the sort of that layer of self-editing go away, you know, and to see what they can really do. Because once it goes away, it's amazing. You know, skills are one thing. Skills are wonderful. And, you know, the kids learn them. But when they're really allowed to show them is when they believe that they don't have to edit themselves and they can be forefront and on the stage, or even if they're, you know, in the background, that they can give it their all and not, you know, apologize for everything that they're doing on stage.
Yeah, that must get pretty wearisome hearing all these apologies, right?
I feel bad. It makes me, I feel frustrated because I know they can do it.
Sure.
Absolutely. And I just want to impart to them that, you know, I was there and, you know, we can all, you know, we can do it. And a lot of times, I mean, for the most part, they get over it and then they have a fabulous experience.
Well, you can use, and you've written a memoir about how you became a performing artist, and you can use yourself as a bit of an example, can't you, in terms of, hey, listen, I got there. I got through this. I did this, you know, and became a performer. Do you use that as part of the whole?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I try not to talk about myself too much because it's really, when we do the program, it really is all about them. But a lot of times I do try to relate things to my own experiences to help them. And it's hard for them to see that I was there. It's kind of like telling a teenager, oh, I remember being a teenager, you know. They're like, sure you do, you know. But
well,
it's the same thing.
I suspect you get the point across. And I really appreciate you coming in this morning.
Oh, thank you.
Lori, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Lori Rubin is the Associate Director of the Ohana Arts Performing Arts Festival and School. She's also an operatic mezzo-soprano who has performed around the world, and she's the author of Do You Dream in Color, a memoir. You can learn more about her on our new website, hpr2.org.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
I'm Stephanie Hughes for New Letters on the Air. This week, Mississippi native and Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Richard Ford sees fiction as a vehicle to provide renewal and awareness.
My message of alienation is that if loneliness is the disease, the story is the cure.
Richard Ford talks with fellow writer Whitney Terrell at the Kansas City Public Library and reads from his novel Canada on the next New Letters on the Air.
This evening at 6:30, right after Marketplace.
Well, that's going to do it for us for this Tuesday morning. But we'll be back with you tomorrow talking about appealing Ho'opili. The Sierra Club says it isn't over yet.
And Hapa's Barry Flanagan on a subject close to his heart and a meeting of the minds over Abraham Lincoln.
You can talk back to your radio, find us and each other on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. We tweet at HI Conversation, or if you want to get me, that's at BecauseHPR.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on our new HPR2.org website. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll be back with you to meet up for more of the conversation.